You're listening to the Arctic Circle podcast. In this episode, we listen to four experts discuss green energy in the Arctic and in the Himalaya Third Pole region. The experts are Haukur Harðarson, chairman and founder of Arctic Green Energy, Adnan Amin, CEO of the Emirates Climate Conference COP28, and Director General Emeritus of the International Renewable Energy Agency, IRENA. Andrew Hall, Chairman of Saxo Limited, Executive Officer of Siemens Gamesa Renewable Energy 2017, and Member of the Advisory Committee on Energy at the Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week. And Benedikt Höskuldsson, Special Envoy for Climate and Permanent Representative of Iceland to IRENA. The panel is followed by a Q&A with the audience, moderated by Nawal Al-Hosani, Permanent Representative of the UAE to IRENA. This event originally took place at the 2023 Arctic Circle Abu Dhabi Forum.
So once more, everybody, we, as I mentioned, we've heard from Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, who is not only now the president designate for COP28, but has been the founder of this amazing platform and also the chairman of Masdar. And we've heard a very inspirational aspiration of what the COP28 is going to be. So looking at our speakers today, and I would like to maybe reiterate some of the key messages that His Excellency just mentioned. We believe that as we move to host COP28 this year, our effort to accelerate the energy transition in the Middle East will be in the spotlight. So in the UAE, I'm sure heard from him and many other speakers throughout the day, through the week, actually. We know that a just and inclusive energy transition must include affordable access to renewables and clean energy solutions, even in the most remote places on the planet which face harsh weather conditions. So how do we do that? How do we foster what Dr. Sultan just mentioned, cross-border, cross-sector collaboration to enhance knowledge and technology exchange with partners from opposite poles of the planet to ensure the international community designs truly global solutions to an urgent global challenge? And how can COP28 this year help facilitate effort to deliver on those goals? So joining us on the stage, I'm hoping soon we will be joined by Mr. Adnan Amin, who is the CEO of COP28. I'm guessing he's just maybe running a little bit late, but hopefully he would be able to join us. Then we have Benedikt, excuse my pronunciation for your name, Höskuldsson. The Special Envoy for Climate and Permanent Representative of Iceland to IRENA, and Håkonur Harðarson, Chairman and Founder of the Arctic Green Energy. Did I pronounce that all right? Thank you. And Mr. Andrew Hall, the Chairman of Green Spur Renewables and members of the Advisory Committee on Energy for Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week. So we have members from the private sector and we have members from the diplomatic corps that would ensure this collaboration happens. So let's start, Benedikt, with you. As a Special Envoy for Climate and Permanent Representative of Iceland to IRENA, and for those of you who don't know what IRENA is, it's the International Renewable Energy Agency that we are very proudly hosting in Abu Dhabi at Masdar City. What do you want to see from... You heard Dr. Sultan speaking about our aspiration for COP28. But from your perspective, what do you want to see from this conference? What does a successful COP look like for you?
Thank you for the question. I think it's a really good one. The first thing that I think we need from this upcoming COP is really to raise ambitions. We really need to raise them because as we have committed today, we're not on the path that we need to be. So that would be my first case. Iceland meets that in the sense that we are actively taking part in the work streams of the UNFCCC with regard to the global stocktake on the mitigation program. And then we are also active in the climate finance issue, which is basically to identify new collective quantifiable finance goals, which is a work progress that will actually, should, we should have some new numbers coming in by 2025. So raising ambition is number one, two, and three, because as you know, we are now, if we look at the NDCs of the member states, we will probably get to a 2.7 degrees by 2050, and that's a world that we cannot accept. There's no question about it. So we need to raise those ambitions. And domestically, back in Reykjavik, in Iceland, we're really meeting the challenge. We have set very ambitious goals for our 2030, the sort of medium-term goals. We are a part of the EU initiative to reduce our emissions by 55%, along with Norway and the European Union countries. In addition, the government has set Iceland a separate 55% goal, which really will put, you know, all our domestic efforts at the forefront, in the sense that in the EU collective scheme, we anticipate that our share of that will be somewhere around 42%. But we have set this additional target of 55, which means that we really need to even go further and hopefully then faster. So I see this as a critical point in time. I see it as where we do raise ambitions, and I do see us now beginning to see if we can leverage the private sector into the equation, which is so direly needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Malik. I have to say that, you know, I have met many people in our industry, but Benedict is one of those people that you always find him in those platforms. Like, you know, I look for him in every COP I go to, and of course at Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week, and we have been friends and partners in this very interesting and hopefully extremely rewarding journey as we move ahead. But one of the things that has been very inspirational for me personally is when I visited Iceland and His Excellency, the former president, but at that time was the president, took the time personally to escort us to all those very innovative platforms and institutions that, you know, has been extremely pioneering in their field. So so the journey to your point has been extremely rewarding for Iceland, and there are so many lessons that we can learn, but that's why we have those very, very useful platforms. Håkon, Arctic Green Energy is a leading renewable energy company with a focus on heating and cooling cities, which is one of the world's most significant energy challenges. So let's look at the role of the private sector that should, and I underline the word should, play in COP28, because we believe that the engagement of the private sectors in COPs is no longer something that is, you know, optional. It's an actual must. So what do you want to see from the upcoming conference that we are hosting in the UAE from the private sector's perspective?
Well, thank you. I found the words of Dr. Sultan quite inspiring. He talked about COP of action and COP of partnership. And a lot of these events in the past have revolved around people talking about doing things. And like His Excellency Olaver mentioned this morning, there are many talkers but fewer doers. So what I think what the private sector would want to see from this COP is really a COP of action, where we take these concepts that have been proven and start to apply them. If we look at my field, cooling and heating of cities, cooling is actually more important than heating, because 70% of the population lives in areas that need cooling rather than heating. But if you think about all the energy that is consumed around the world every year, used, not consumed, more than half of this energy is heating and cooling. And without us addressing the way to do a proper energy transition for heating and cooling, we will not meet any carbon neutrality goals. But these technologies that we are applying are proven, they are renewable, they are baseload, they are profitable, they offer energy security, they offer price stability. And geothermal energy, which is the energy source we use, is available in its low temperature form literally everywhere in the world. And yet, you look around you and you see 80% of cities and towns around the world still using fossil fuels. to heat and cool their cities. So a COP of action and a COP of partnerships. I'd really like to see that to help us in the private sector bring those ideas into action. More action, less talk.
So COP of action, but also we are looking forward to make it a cool COP, because we were just involved yesterday or the day before yesterday on the work that is the Cooling Coalition is doing with the with IRENA, UNFCCC, the UNDP, and SE for All, and the importance of cooling. And to your point, it's not only about cooling the cities, but also it's very important for food storage and for health services and vaccines, because those solutions are very, very important and critical, and they consume a lot of energy. So when and they have not actually been looked at in any COP on any kind of they didn't take their right share of a spotlight in the international arenas. Andrew, Green Spur says it's found the rare earth-free solution to energy generation, which addresses critical material supply chain risks. Can you explain for us why does a generator need to be rare earth free in the first place, and how can it help provide access to clean energy in remote areas?
Thank you. Yes. Many people are not aware of the fact that most of the wind turbines use critical rare earth materials. Now, there are two aspects to critical rare earth materials. One is they're extremely toxic and very difficult to mine in a clean and environmental and sustainable manner. Because of their rarity, as the name suggests, they're also extremely expensive, and the materials are prices are extremely volatile. And this inhibits the development and expansion of wind technology, both onshore and offshore worldwide. So we really need to find an alternative. If we're going to scale up the amount of wind that the wind power that the world needs in order to decarbonize, we need to find more readily available minerals that are able to be deployed within the wind generators. And what we've developed is a technology that enables us to use basically ferrite, which is standard iron ore or iron oxide. And that is available, as you know, in many places around the world through scrap metal or, you know, existing mining activities.
Thank you. I want to stay on this topic of helping energy access and providing to providing it for remote areas. So, Benedict, how does Iceland's renewable energy strategy fit into this ecosystem? What can we learn from it, and how are you looking into collaborating with the international community to exchange knowledge and technologies?
As you, most of you probably know, you know, we do advocate for utilization of geothermal energy. And as Haukur has already stated, you know, the options, the possibilities to use low temperature, direct use of geothermal is basically something that we can do globally. What makes me really sort of optimistic right now is that after the IRENA 13th Assembly, which just finished on Sunday, they introduced to us through the Global Geothermal Alliance, which is a dedicated stream within their work plan, that they are now focused on the low temperature utilization. And I do believe that, and we have pledged as Iceland to work very closely with them in promoting this option. And I do think that this is the way you can actually apply geothermal to closing the energy poverty gap. As Dr. Sultan mentioned, we had promised to leave no one behind. But let's think about what that really means. We do have over 700 million people who are without any electrical access whatsoever. We have 2.4 billion people without access to clean cooking or technologies. The IEA has indicated that if we do not pass through SDG 7, by 2030, we will not reach Paris. So in the next 8 years, we've got to close the poverty gap, and there's no other way. Now, here is where I do think that actually geothermal, low-temperature geothermal, comes in to play, and actually because you can now possibly address the off-grid populations, which these 700 million really represent. They are on off the grid. They are not connected. And the only way to connect them is through standalone systems. And the low temperature utilization actually provides that. In Iceland right now, we have a company, a Swedish company, that's actually running three pilots on this, two in Japan. And if this becomes successful, I do believe we will see geothermal becoming a really important part of this equation, because leave no one behind really means closing this poverty gap. We need to do it.
Absolutely, I can't agree more. And on this topic of developing, sharing tech and knowledge, maybe we need to learn a little bit how the Arctic Green Energy and how it's, where its operation and how your multinational presence helped to inform the work that you are developing.
Yeah, well, we stand on the shoulders of generations of Icelandic engineers and scientists that developed these solutions in Iceland. And Iceland, as you may know, close to 100% of the space heating in Iceland is done with geothermal energy. So when I founded Arctic Green Energy, it was sort of around the idea of exporting this to other markets where I saw pollution rise quite fast. Even if I'm Icelandic, I live in Vietnam, I live in Asia. So we have now this company in China that currently is the world's largest geothermal district heating company. And we are serving about 75 cities and towns in China. But when we started, there was no geothermal industry in China. And now what we have done in China has become the world's largest of its type. So this is maybe a typical way of how we can share our knowledge. We build the joint ventures always with local companies, preferably energy companies. And we, you know, our joint ventures help them to decarbonize. We also help them to shape and create the legal system around the geothermal. So, for example, in China, we are a national showcase of how to drill, explore, and harness geothermal. And this is a formula that we are applying in other markets and hope to continue that for decades. Just to give you an idea of a scale, the total carbon savings from our work already far exceeds the carbon savings of Iceland.
So you're setting a bit of a target for Benedikt to move on with it.
Maybe I can borrow from him a little bit.
So Andrew, public engagement has been extremely, extremely important. So what the Green Spurs model for engaging with the public sector to drive this energy transition? How do you see the potential or maybe the necessity of this public-private partnership in the energy transition?
That's an interesting question. I think the foremost in everybody's minds is, you know, the particularly in renewable, the development of renewable generation, solar and wind in particular around the world, it's mostly concentrated to serve about a fifth of the world's population. But about four-fifths of the world's investment in renewable energy is in those sort of developed markets. And it's mostly in utility-scale energy generation rather than microgrid and off-grid solutions, which are more applicable to, you know, rural and isolated communities around the world. Public-private partnership, and public has a role to play in particularly in accelerating the energy transition, you know, moving from action to, from talk to action in COP28, is we need to have governments and intergovernmental institutions put regulations in place that are not going to hinder or slow, but actually accelerate the permitting and approval procedures that are required for geothermal energy for solar, utility scale solar, utility scale wind, and also microgrid and off-grid solutions of energy. So it is really, you know, companies out there, technology is available, financing is available. What we see is that the permitting processes are just far too long to allow us to achieve what we need to achieve as an industry in helping decarbonize the world's energy infrastructure.
Thank you. Benedict, another platform that you are very engaged with is the Sustainable Energy for All, and you have been from the beginning. How do you see bringing energy access to the 700 million people that don't have access? What are the challenges from your perspective and opportunities to bring action and impact on the ground in off-grid, low-resource, remote areas?
Yes, Sustainable Energy for All is entirely focused on the SDG 7 target. And the one Leave No One Behind actually confronts the question of how to eradicate the energy poverty that exists. I think the issues have been finance, really, honestly. And one of the things that makes me at least optimistic right now is that we do have sort of new innovative ways in which we are trying to finance the off-grid, particularly because it is a question of the off-grid solutions. And C4All has now recently established a small facility, a funding facility, that uses research-based finance mechanisms, where you literally begin to shift the sort of the risk of the project away from the governments onwards to the project developers. I think that is important because, as we all know, the governments of Sub-Saharan Africa, where 80% of the 700 million people live, are really stretched when it comes to their budgets. So there is a need for innovative ways to finance these solutions. So research-based finance is one. I think another one that's really promising as well is blended finance. And we've been working, Iceland has been working with the other Nordic countries and the US in order to develop ways in which we can provide sort of junior equity into some projects, then trying to attract then the private sector to come and participate with us, because when it comes to the energy problems related to the off-grid, related to the poverty, you need private sector. The private sector we need to have market-driven solutions to close this gap. There is no other way. So let's face that. And let's then see how we can, through different mechanisms, actually bring in the private capital. Just to throw out a little bit of a number, you know, we the high income countries, we have literally struggled with bringing the 100 billion that we promised to begin to deliver annually in 2020. We are getting closer. We are at some 84 billion last year, but we struggle with that. But then think about that the estimated need to close the gap and to do the transition is around $4+ trillion. So there is no, I think John Kerry said it earlier this week, there is no public budget that can cover that cost. We need the private sector to come in here. And if you think about this, more than $4 trillion is 1% of the investment volume that the private sector sits on. They sit on $410 trillion investments. So we need 1%. So the money is there. I think it's up to us, through different partnerships, through different, you know, unorthodox partnerships, to unleash this. And if we think we work towards that, I think we will be successful.
I cannot agree more. But another important element that we need to include and think of is entrepreneurship. And this is maybe Hawker can tell us a little bit more about the role of entrepreneurship in bringing energy to remote areas. How can we foster this entrepreneurial mindset in these areas to help develop and the local capabilities?
Well, you know, my point of view is maybe a little bit narrower than some of the others because I focus on geothermal energy. And to bring energy solutions to off-grid locations is something that is very, very suitable for geothermal energy. And we can serve communities, maybe down to 1,500, 2,000 people, and the operation is still a profitable thing. So I think Benedict is right. You know, the private sector needs to drive this. It cannot be the governments, and the private sector needs to get a proper return on its investment. And that's something that geothermal has. It is a good business. And as His Excellency President Ólafur has sometimes pointed out in his speeches, that the reason Iceland brought geothermal to all communities was not because it was a grand decarbonization vision. It was simply a good business for all the communities, good and small. So I hope that answers some of it.
Thank you. It does, actually. So, Andrew, we spoke about the mindset of the entrepreneurship, but what technologies should we keep an eye on for when it comes to game-changing advanced tech solutions to the energy transition?
I think in particular for rural and off-grid communities around the world, the development of grid-scale renewable energy generation has led to massive cost reductions that we're all now accustomed to and know in solar and wind, where solar and wind today are the cheapest forms of energy that on the planet. So we need to make these available to those rural communities. Now, because the technologies are cheap, microgrid and off-grid solutions have become more and more viable and becoming increasingly interesting to communities that either don't have access to reliable power supply or the power is not affordable. So I think the development of the technology of wind and solar are very interesting. The disadvantage of wind and solar is that it's an intermittent resource. So when the sun shines, we have power. At nighttime, there's no power. And particularly, I know in Africa, that's a big issue because children, for instance, go to school during the day. They don't study or don't do their homework during the day, and they work as well out in the fields and helping their parents provide food. At nighttime is typically when they would start studying, and they study by candlelight. So providing pure solar lighting would enable enormous enhancement for these communities just through improved education and ability to study. So this intermittency is a real issue that needs to be resolved. Now, there are two ways of doing it. One, and the most common, is through battery storage. The issue with battery storage is it's great for the developed world. Lithium-ion batteries are great, but they still cost $200 per kilowatt hour. Whereas solar, an example, is 10 cents, under 10 cents per kilowatt hour. So there's a long way to go before battery storage becomes competitive and available to these communities. Geothermal, on the other hand, is a baseload capacity that could provide baseload energy through 24/7, and it's a technology that's very well understood. And we know that it is a technology that can be provided at a cost that is extremely comparable to solar and wind today. And I think it's the combination of these multiple energy, renewable energy sources, whether it be hydro, solar, wind, geothermal, that are really going to be game-changing for these communities around the world.
Thank you so much. You know, I've always looked into any challenge to turn it into an opportunity. So missing one speaker for us is an opportunity to tap into the audience and give you the opportunity to ask those energy leaders questions. And we have around 15 minutes for the audience. So any questions from the floor?
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting. Presentations of ideas, you know, to how we can make the best use of COP28. Chair, I have a question to any one of the distinguished panelists. Now we work in the Hindu Kush Himalayan region, the third pole, and you know, the discussion that took place just now really hits at the core of the problems that we have in terms of energy. So the remote mountain communities in the Himalayas, in the Hindu Kush ranges, do not have access to grid electricity because of the high cost of transmission. So this is an ideal solution. So what kind of advice would you give, the approach that we should take, you know, from the regional center, from ISIMO, the International Center for Integrated Mountain Development, to be able to, you know, provide this solution to the remote mountain communities in the third pole? Thank you.
I think each of our speakers can bring a different perspective to this to this question. So, Andrew, I'll start with you.
Thank you. I think it's the first of all is regulation. Have the right regulatory environment to encourage the development of microgrid and off-grid solutions, and on a commercial basis rather than subsidized. Then the technologies around microgrid and off-grid should be viewed as community, a kind of community service that can be provided to multiple, you know, communities in a particular region. So focusing on microgrid, off-grid, combination of various technologies like solar, wind and storage or baseload capacity like geothermal on a small scale to serve a local distribution network in the communities is probably the most economical way about going to, you know, provide access to energy. I mean, that would be my advice. Now, there are companies there that do develop, like Mazda, that do develop renewable energy assets. They do it at utility scale. There are, and those companies are increasingly looking at, because of the price and the, you know, the low returns in utility scale solar and wind, they're looking at increased opportunities of looking at commercial and industrial applications, and also even, you know, rooftop or housing applications of solar. And I'm talking very much from the developing world point of view. What's interesting is that exactly the same transition is happening in the developed world, where you're seeing increased use. Because of the high energy prices in Europe and America, you're seeing increased growth in solar rooftop, heat pumps, electric vehicle charging, systems being placed on or in houses or commercial estates. So I think, you know, use the technology, use the capabilities, and approach those institutions or companies that are already involved in the space to help then commercially develop these microgrid and off-grid solutions.
Can I? Yes, if I might just, I'd love to give you an example of what we're, for example, doing with India. Last year, the Prime Ministers of India and Iceland formed a task force to strengthen the relations in the area of energy. And we have now begun to work with the Indian government on how to enhance their geothermal projects. We have two pilots that are being undertaken, one in the basin of the Himalayas and one another one up in the Ladakh region. And and the goal there is to actually set up a project that will actually provide base load, as we've talked about, base load, geothermal, electrical energy to the populations of in that region. And one of the key elements here, because we've been trying to work with the Indians on this for quite a long time, and I really do foresee now success. And the reason is that this has now filtered into the Indian government system. So now there is a keen interest within the civil servants side of this equation. And what we have decided to do is, and I have asked Irina to support us to actually host a workshop for the civil servants in Delhi to actually support them in working on the new, on the geothermal. The fact is that, you know, when you're dealing with civil servants who may know certain types of energy resources, you know, whether it's oil and gas or sun, solar or wind, geothermal is most of the time, you know, absent when it comes to the knowledge. So I think it's critical in this collaboration effort that we're having with the Indians to bring along the IRENA, do a workshop, focus on the civil servants, because we have been actually educating Indian scientists for a long time. So there is a basin for that, but we cannot forget the other side of the equation, which is the civil servants who actually need to, you know, set the regulations, set the rules, and then work with those. So I think that gives at least me hope that we will be successful going forward.
Yes, and if I may add to this, you know, renewable energies are always a local solution. The composition of co-generating between the energy classes changes from place to place. But one very important aspect to point out regarding geothermal, maybe for poorer or less fortunate communities, is in the two words, it's renewable and baseload. What does this mean? The energy is always on, whether you use it or not. So by doing this, you can do what we do in China. We offer our customers a fixed fee. There is no metering. So there is no uncertainty about the energy. There is no correlation to global commodity prices. And I think this is a very, very important part of the solution for the poorer community. They know exactly what they're going to be paying, and it's actually going to be quite a bit cheaper than for the fossil fuels.
Please.
Yes, thank you. My name is Rasmus Bertelsen. I'm a professor of international relations at the Arctic University of Norway, and I'm this year's Nansen professor at the University of Akureyri in Iceland. I think we are faced with two extremely challenging questions globally. We have climate, and then as a political scientist, of course, there's very rapidly rising levels of conflict in the international political system. These are especially conflicts between the United States and China and the United States and Russia. We have a major war going on in Europe, and we have rapidly rising tensions in Asia. People are talking about decoupling, deglobalization, etc. How do we navigate those two crises at the same time, the long-term climate crisis and the immediate political, economic, security crisis? And can you do these projects which you're talking about here, which are extremely beneficial for the climate situation? To what extent are these projects affected by the trends of deglobalization, decoupling, and rising levels of political and economic conflict? Thank you.
If I may answer this one. A lot of the things you mentioned, there are wars and world seems to be going into all kinds of different directions. But the climate belongs to all of us. And this is actually one of maybe the few remaining bridges in the world that bridge peoples and cultures, because pollution does not respect any borders. So, and maybe this is also something to build on politically, that people can argue about all kinds of things, but they cannot argue about the quality of life of having access to clean air and clean environment. So I think the renewables build bridges, not divisions.
We want a diplomatic answer as well.
Yeah, I think the diplomatic answer would be that what we try to do is to separate the issues so that we can work with those where the conflicts are, you know, on issues such as the climate separately. So trying to really keep, the issues clear and without polluting them with other geopolitical issues. So it's to sort of separate the lanes, keep the lanes separate. I think that's the best way for us to do this. And we do this actually, you know, we've done it in different areas. But you're absolutely spot on. This is really difficult. But I think what Haukur is also sort of emphasizing is that, you know, when it comes to the climate, that It's a whole different mindset that we need to apply, because there are no borders. It's a non-border issue, and it impacts everybody. So I think that is the sort of, and that's, we have been quite successful actually in separating the two when we do and speak climate, renewables, or whatever it is. So that would be my diplomatic answer.
Yeah, I'll add a different perspective, and it's a positive one, because the regional conflicts and the, you know, diversification of China, the US, and to a certain extent Europe has led to a lot of companies, and with some political backing, to certainly in the West, to rethink their supply chains, which has been good, because it's not only provided wealth and value to a number of other countries, developing countries around the world, it is also increasing the resilience of the supply chains in the renewable energy industry. And this resilience exhibits itself in a bigger capacity to be able to expand and deliver on the requirements of solar and wind and battery infrastructure around the world. So it is, at the end of the day, I think it will benefit the climate transition rather than hinder it.
Fantastic. We have time for one question, and that's... two questions. Yeah. Because I would love to hear from a woman. That's actually great, you know, being in a male-dominated conference, it seems. So it's nice to hear from a woman.
Hello, good morning. I'm Subarna Bhattacharya, and extremely honored to be part of this meeting. I'm from United States, California. We have a climate tech company. We do climate predictions and climate modeling. My question to you, sir, is you were talking about the geothermal energy, and how does that compare to the wind and solar? Like, we know that wind and solar have this intermittency problem that you addressed, and, you know, the variable energy production kind of thing. But how does that compare to the geothermal? Is it available everywhere, or is it special to certain locations where you do have geothermal activities?
All renewables are really a local solution. You know, the wind, there's a different amount of winds in the different locations, and so it is for geothermal. But many people do not make the distinction between what is called high temperature geothermal, which we use to generate electricity. And you know, proper high temperature geothermal is limited maybe to areas that are volcanic. You know, you find that in, you know, Iceland, the Ring of Fire in Asia. But the much more valuable part of geothermal is mid to low temperature, which is ideal for heating and cooling. And that is available almost everywhere. And people sometimes overlook this, because in their mind, they think that geothermal energy infrastructure is a big power station built next to a volcano. Yes, that's part of it. But the lower temperature, which is ideal for heating, cooling, food drying, even greenhouses, fish farming, this is available virtually everywhere. It's not 100%, but close.
Thank you. And how far do you have to go into the ground to get that?
It depends, but we have done over 900 geothermal wells, and the average depth is 2.2 kilometers. So that's a kind of a uniform number, but within that you find wells that are 800 meters deep and others that are 5 kilometers deep. But 2 kilometers, it's like, was it 1.4 miles or something? Yeah, that's about it.
Thank you. Can I have just the last gentleman at the back there for the last 3 minutes we have?
I'm going to try to keep it short. So I loved your input there on how technologies which are being used in developing countries are now being put into place at developed countries because it makes sense. I work for a publication called The Third Pole, which we set up about 13 years ago, which covers the Hindu Kush Himalayan region, the transboundary rivers. And one of the things that we keep coming back to is that these are places that are defined as risks and not as sites of innovation. And I was wondering if either you or Hugh would like to respond on this and the fact that actually until these things are seen as possibilities of drivers of prosperity, whether through the proper use of biodiversity with new innovations, people will not invest in them. And these are poor regions. They need investment.
Yeah, I like thinking of things in terms of paradigms, and the developed world's energy infrastructure is in a big paradigm. The paradigm is large generation capacity, so nuclear, gas, large hydropower, and then a distribution network that distributes the power to everybody. The developing world don't have that privilege everywhere. So they, out of necessity, they don't think in the same paradigms. So what's happened with a renewable transition in the developed world is that the paradigm of large centralized generation has continued into renewables. So everybody talks about large offshore wind, 1 gigawatt, 2 gigawatt, 10 gigawatt. They talk about large wind farms, 1 gigawatt solar farms. But nobody thinks that actually, by definition, wind and solar is a distributed energy resource. The marginal cost of capacity is very, very low compared to, a nuclear power plant. So the developed world's stuck in this paradigm, whereas the developing world hasn't had that privilege of being in that paradigm. And they are able to adopt the technology and adapt it and apply it to their particular needs, where energy supply is not secure, so it's energy security is one issue. There's also a high cost of distribution, so grid arbitrage is another area that promotes microgrid and off-grid, and then you've got the rural and isolated communities that have never had access to energy. And now, with the low marginal cost, they're able to afford this.
Just very briefly, I think another important driver in this context is basically that, governments, countries, have, as of 2015, committed them to actually achieve certain climate goals. And so it is not only a question of, is it feasible in terms of as an investment? They've committed to this. They need to report on this. So it's also that fact that actually countries around the globe, the Paris Agreement is unique in the sense when it comes to the climate that we have over 190 countries actually committed to this. And I think that's a driver in this instance as well. Plus, as Andrew said.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Can I just give our speakers a round of applause, please? Thank you. And I would like to conclude before I hand to His Excellency Mr. Grimson. As Dr. Sultan mentioned, it's going to be a COP collaboration, a COP opportunities, and we have a COP28 pavilion here at Abu Dhabi Sustainability Week. Please do pass by the pavilion. If you have any ideas, any thoughts that you would like to share with the team, I'm sure they would be more than delighted to hear from you. So thank you very much. Thank you, Your Excellency, for the platform.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Naval and the panelists for this session. And before I invite you to have some lunch and refreshments, hopefully here or here at the table, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that this morning we had three sessions. We had one on the aggressive melting of the glaciers and the ice in the Third Pole Himalaya region and also in the Arctic. We had the presentation by the president of COP28 of the climate vision. And we had this informative, stimulating, visionary discussion about the renewable energy transformation. I have increasingly said in different gatherings, because the dialogue on climate is kind of complicated for most people. It's to some extent a scientific, academic discussion. And to simplify it, I have presented this core triangle. ICE, energy, climate. And those three sessions this morning demonstrate the connection. The ice is melting in the Arctic, in Antarctica, in the Himalayas. Therefore, we have extreme weather patterns. We have the destruction of the monsoon systems. We even have weather season changing in Japan, as was discussed yesterday, because of what's happening in the Himalaya region. We have the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which raises sea level. If only a quarter of the Greenland ice sheet melts by 2 meters, that would be a monumental threat to Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Singapore, Shanghai. So the challenge is to stop the glaciers from melting. If we can succeed in stopping the glaciers from melting, there would not be any climate crisis. And although most people on the planet have difficulty in understanding this complicated climate discussion, everybody understands ice. Everybody has some experience of the melting of the ice. So the core question is how we stop the ice from melting. The only way to do it is a comprehensive clean energy transformation everywhere in the world. And it's doable, as has been said here, especially in cooling and heating houses, which is 50% of the problem, in the mega cities, especially Asia and Africa. And don't let us forget, in less than 30 years' time, 3/4 of the global population will live in Asia and Africa. And 2/3 of them will live in cities. So this battle will be won and lost on the energy field in these mega cities, especially in Asia and Africa, how they cool and heat their houses. And if we can do those two corners of the triangle, the third corner, climate will take care of itself. Will take care of itself. So I thank all of you who have here this morning, the scientists, the world-class scientists, Dr. Sultan Al-Jaber, Dr. Naval, and the panelists for this contribution. We will come together again at 1:30 and start with a session on science diplomacy, how science can help countries and communities and leaders to work together. How, in fact, the field of science, which traditionally has been isolated from political dialogue and diplomacy, can, in fact, help to bring that effectively together. And that will be followed by a session on cooperation across borders and boundaries, which is the essence of our task. And we will conclude the forum with an open democratic dialogue among everybody, among the participants, about the next steps and how we move forward from here. And with those words, I thank you again. And we create an interval until 1:30, where we will start with the discussion on science diplomacy. Thank you.